10 Days by Nina Allen. Narrated by Jill Tanner.
10 days, 10 hours, 10 minutes. A man is murdered and a woman is charged. The hangman winds his watch and then goes home. I don't suppose you remember that old Cher lyric, "You're too young." If I could turn back time, if I could find a way. My best friend from law school, Frieda Solomon, used to play that track at the end of every party she ever threw, when we were solidly pissed and everyone was dancing, even those of us who never danced, when discussion had dissolved into barracking and all the ugly home truths began to come out. The song is about someone who said something stupid and wishes she hadn't. Hardly a crime when you think of the appalling things people do to one another every day and can't take back. What are mere words, you might ask, in the face of deeds? I'm not so sure myself. What if the person Cher is singing to happens to be some hotshot international trader with revenge on his mind, or a fighter pilot, or a president with his finger on the button? Who knows what someone like that might do if you caught them at the wrong moment? One thoughtless comment and it's World War III. Who knows? If I could turn back time, my dear, I wouldn't change a thing. It takes about 2 minutes for a time machine to get going, in my experience. Nothing happens for what seems like forever. Then just as you're telling yourself you were an idiot to believe, even for 10 seconds, that such a thing would be possible, the edges of things, your fingers, your sight lines, your thoughts, begin to blur, to stumble off kilter, and then you're gone. Or not gone as such, but there. Your surroundings appear oddly familiar, because of course they are. The time you have left seems insubstantial suddenly, a peculiar daydream fantasy. Vivid while you were having it, but, like most dreams, irretrievable on waking. There was a man who lived next door to us when we were children, whose house was stuffed to the rafters with old radios. The type he liked best were the wooden console models from before the war. But he kept Bakelite sets too, and those tinny little transistors from the 1950s. His main obsession was a hefty wooden box full of burnt-out circuits and coils he claimed had once belonged to a wireless set used by the French resistance in World War II. He was forever trying to restore the thing, but I think there were pieces missing, and so far as I know, he never got it working again. I used to spend hours round at his house, going through the boxes of junk and watching what he was doing. Our mother couldn't stand Gary Tonks. She would have stopped me having anything to do with him if she could. Looking back on it now, I suppose she thought there was something peculiar about his interest in me. But there was never anything like that. Nothing you could point a finger at, anyway. When I was 13, Gary Tonks was sectioned under the Mental Health Act. His house was infested with rats, and he kept insisting that one of his radios had started picking up signals from Mars. I remember taking pictures of the house afterwards with the Kodak Instamatic Uncle Henry had given me for my 10th birthday, pretending I was working for MI5. I still feel bad about that. I think now that Gary Tonks's radio might have been picking up not signals from Mars, but the voices of people who had lived in the house before him, or who would live there in the future after he'd gone. Time doesn't give a damn about the laws of physics. It does what it wants. I think of Helen's basement living room in Camden, the ancient Aubusson carpet faded to a dusty monochrome, the books, the burnt orange scent of chrysanthemums. I sometimes wish I could go back there just to see it again, but I know I can't. I've had my turn. And stealing more time could be dangerous, not just for me and for Helen, but for you as well. When I was 18, I contracted leukemia. I was very ill for about 10 months, and then I recovered. Against the odds, the doctor said, and only after the kind of cliched regime of brutal chemo you read about in the colour supplements. And yes, there were times I wished they'd give up on me and let me die. I suspect, in fact I know, it was my brother Martin who persuaded me to stick around. His white face at my bedside, I can still see it now. His terror that I wasn't going to pull through, I suppose. I don't think I've mattered like that to anyone before or since, and that includes Ray. I hung on and hung on, until suddenly there I was, washed up on the shore of life once more, and the tide of those months receding like some lurid sick joke. But there were side effects. I'd been offered a place at Cambridge to read mathematics. Following my illness, I found something was missing. The instinctive affinity for numbers I had taken for granted as an inseparable part of me was, if not vanished, then noticeably blunted. It was like thinking through gauze. My professor seemed confident that I was simply exhausted, that any diminution in my ability would soon be restored. Perhaps she was right. I'll never know now, will I? The university offered me the option to defer my entry for a further year, but I refused. I turned down my place, partly from the terror of failure and partly to match the drama that was playing out inside my head with something concrete that could be measured in the world outside. I was having a breakdown, in other words, and in the aftermath of that, I switched to law. I know it doesn't sound like much when you put it like that, but the decision hurt a lot at the time. It felt like the worst kind of defeat. I won't say I ever got over the loss, but I learned to live with it the same as you do with any bereavement. And in time, I even came to enjoy my legal studies. There is a beauty in the law, in which the abstraction of numbers is countered by the wily and intricate compromises of philosophy. Call it compensation, if you like. An out-of-court settlement that, if not generous, has at least proved adequate. I'm good at my job, I think, and it has provided me with a decent living in return. And whenever I find myself growing maudlin for what might have been, I remind myself that the law has also provided me with what Martin sometimes jokingly refers to as Dora's file on the doomed, an interest that began as a tree branch of curiosity and grew into a passion. If I am known to the public at all, it is for my articles and radio broadcasts on the subject of capital punishment and the fatal miscarriages of justice that have been associated with this barbaric practice. For many years, the essays I wrote for various history and politics journals formed the limit of my ambition for my researches. It was Martin, of course, who first suggested I should write a book, and the more I thought about the idea, the more I liked it. My first thought was to write a monograph on capital punishment in general, a philosophical treatise to be accompanied by a thorough debunking, a literary bollocking, if you like. I soon came to realise how dull such a volume would be, unless you had an interest in the subject to begin with, which would make the whole thing pointless, a sermon to the converted. I came to the conclusion that a more personal approach would work better, an in-depth study of specific cases, of one specific case even. What better way to demonstrate the brutality of state-sanctioned murder than to tell the story of one of its victims? To show that murder is always murder, even when enshrined in law, with the same practical margin for error and moral depravity that murder entails. My decision to write about Helen Bostel was made quickly and easily. As a story, her case had everything you might look for in a decent thriller. The condemned criminal was also a woman, which made the case a cause célèbre even at the time. People are fascinated by women who kill, in much the same way as they are fascinated by genetic freaks, and with the same mixture of self-righteous indignation and covert repulsion. For my own part, I became interested in Helen because I admired her writing, and also because from the moment I first encountered what passed for the facts of her case, I found myself convinced she was not guilty. Not that I would have ceased to admire her, necessarily, if she had been a murderer. Edwin Dillon was an arrogant prick, if you ask me, but her innocence made her the perfect candidate for my thesis. I would do her justice, I decided, if not in deed, then in word, at the very least. I've read interviews with biographers in which they wax on about having a special kinship with their subjects, a personal relationship across time that could never have existed in reality. I would once have dismissed such speculation as sentimental codswallop. Not any more, though. Helen Bostel was born in 1895 in Addiscombe, Croydon. Her father, Winston Bostel, was a doctor and lay preacher. Her mother, Edith, had worked as a teacher, though she gave up her career entirely after she married. The two were well-matched, forward-thinking people who gave their only daughter, Helen, every opportunity to develop her intellectual awareness of the world and her place within it. "I might have been content," Helen wrote in her 1923 pamphlet essay, On War, On Murder. "Content to take up my place among the teachers, preachers, poets and painters I had learned to admire as a very young woman. To speak my protest, but timidly, from inside the very system I was protesting. It was the spectacle of war that made me a radical, that fired in me the conviction that the system I was protesting had to be broken. The war, and more specifically the death on the Somme of her cousin Peter Arnold Bostel, the son of her father's brother Charles. Peter and Helen, both only children and of a similar age, had been close throughout their childhoods. At the outbreak of war in 1914, Peter had just graduated from Oxford and was considering whether to take up a junior fellowship offered to him by his college, or to embark on a research trip to Madagascar with his other uncle, his mother's brother, the entomologist Rupert Paxton. It is not known whether Peter and Helen had plans to marry, although judging by the letters the two exchanged while Peter was at Oxford, it is certainly a possibility. There is no doubt that Helen was devastated by her cousin's death, locking herself away in her room for several weeks afterwards, and ultimately falling ill with pneumonia. She emerged from her illness a different person, determined to play her part in creating a more just society, a society in which a death such as her cousin's would not be possible. When the war ended, she took up lodgings in Hampstead, close to the house where John Keats once lived, and began taking in private pupils. During the hours she was not teaching, she was studying and writing. She also joined a suffragist group. Her parents, though initially upset by her abrupt departure from the family home and concerned for her health, were tentatively supportive of her aims. Until she met Edwin Dillon. Then everything changed. Edwin Dillon was 30 years old, a journalist on the Manchester Guardian, who had written a number of inflammatory articles on the employment conditions of factory workers in the north of England. He had lost three fingers of his left hand in an unspecified industrial accident, although there was some talk that he had inflicted the injury himself to avoid conscription. He came south to London in 1919. quickly establishing links with the community of Russian anarchists and dissident Marxists living there in exile from the Bolshevik Revolution. It was likely to have been Dylan's views on free love that set Helen's parents so thoroughly against Dylan, although it could simply have been that they didn't much like him. Hector Dubois, the proprietor of the Liberty Bookshop in Camden and a former associate of Dylan's, testified in support of Helen Bostel at her trial. He described Edwin Dylan as a man you need to be careful around, a man who held a grudge. There were also rumours that Dylan's original motive for coming to London had to do with a woman he had made pregnant in Manchester and later abandoned. Attempts to trace this woman ended in failure, and so the rumours could not be verified. Whatever the reason, Winston and Edith Bostel were determined that their daughter should have nothing more to do with Edwin Dylan. When Helen announced that she was intending to move into Dylan's rooms in Camden, her parents threatened to cut all ties with her. Perhaps they hoped to call her bluff. If so, it was a gamble that backfired. In February of 1927, Helen gave up her Hampstead lodgings and moved into the basement flat at 112 Milliver Road. I soon found myself accruing vast amounts of information, not just on Helen Bostel, but on her whole family. I can imagine many editors dismissing most of it as irrelevant. Who cared about Winston Bostel's run-in with a colleague in 1907 over the involuntary committal of an unmarried mother to a mental asylum, if you're interested, when the incident had zero connection to the case in hand? But the more I dug into the private lives of the Bostels and their circle, the more I became convinced that they were important. Crime does not arise in a vacuum. A murder is simply the flashpoint in a gradual accretion of narrative. The various strands that make up that narrative, Winston Bostel's mortal hatred of violence, Edith Bostel's inability to conceive another child, Peter Bostel's ambiguous relationship with his uncle, Rupert Paxton, may all be contributing factors in its final outcome. And besides that, I was interested. The Bostels were an unremarkable family on the face of it, and yet their lives provided a snapshot of an entire era. In the conflicts and setbacks they encountered, it was possible to discern the birth of the modern age and the decline of empire, the fireworks and anxieties that occurred when the two collided. Was it any wonder that a woman like Helen Bostel, educated, resourceful, and unwilling to settle for the life that society had preordained for her, ended up finding herself directly in the firing line? The shadow side of my researches was the strange vacuity surrounding the person of Edwin Dylan. Information about the Bostels proved plentiful and easy to come by. This was partly because of the crime, of course. Call someone a murderer and suddenly every detail of their life becomes interesting, becomes evidence. But that was not the only reason. The Bostels, Helen herself, but also Winston, Edith, Peter, Rupert, and especially Rupert's wife Marina, who was Russian, and embraced the literary arts as the birthright they were all copious, inveterate letter writers and journal keepers. Their histories remained bright, remained present. Searching for information about Edwin Dylan came to seem like staring into a black hole. I became convinced that if Dylan hadn't been murdered, he would have disappeared from history altogether. I turned up odd pieces of his journalism here and there, but finding images of the man himself was another matter. Aside from the blurry photograph that so often featured in the newspapers at the time of Helen's trial, Edwin Dylan might as well have been invisible. In the end, I decided it would be better to set all the background material aside for the moment and concentrate on the timeline of the case itself. It was like working on a proof, in a way. Carry one distinct line of inquiry through to its logical conclusion, and the rest will follow. The actual order of events was easy enough to assemble from the trial records. A little before 8 o'clock in the evening of the 20th of January, 1928, a Mrs. Irene Wilbur, a widow who lived in the ground floor apartment of 112 Milliver Road, was disturbed by what she called a furious altercation in the flat below. Concerned by what she heard, "It sounded like they were bashing each other's brains out," was what she said on the witness stand. She left her flat and hurried to the Red Lion public house, approximately a minute's walk away, helping to enlist the aid of the publican in locating a police constable. When asked why she did not call at Dylan's apartment herself, she insisted she was afraid to. "The noise they were making," she said, "it was as if the devil had got into them." The publican of the Red Lion, Gerald Honeyshot, confirmed that Irene Wilbur came into the pub soon after 8 o'clock. He left with her more or less immediately, and they walked together to Camden Town Underground Station, where they were able to secure the services of PC Robert Greystow, who passed by the station regularly on his beat. The three then returned to 112 Milliver Road, where on entry into the hallway they found the house silent, and the door leading to Dylan's apartment standing ajar. "I knew straight away there'd been a murder done," Irene Wilbur claimed in her statement. "You could feel it in the air. Something about the silence. It wasn't right." At this point, Greystow gave instructions for Wilbur and Honeyshot to remain upstairs in the hallway while he entered the basement apartment alone. He called out to Mr. and Mrs. Dylan as he entered, but there was no reply. A short time later, he re-emerged and informed Wilbur and Honeyshot that they would need to report to the police station on Highgate Road immediately in order to give their witness statements. He did not offer them any further information at this point, but by the end of the evening, both Wilbur and Honeyshot knew that Edwin Dylan had been murdered. According to PC Greystow, he had discovered Dylan within moments of entering the flat. He was in the kitchen. His clothes were soaked with blood, and more blood was spreading in a large puddle across the kitchen tiles. Edwin Dylan was pronounced dead where he lay. He had been stabbed 5 times. 2 of the wounds were serious enough to have killed him. There was no sign anywhere of Helen Bostel. An officer was left on duty outside the house, and when Helen eventually returned home at around 11 o'clock, she was taken immediately into police custody. On being asked where she had spent the evening, she said she had been at the house of a friend, Daphne Evans, who lived in Highgate. Daphne quickly confirmed Helen's alibi, but when officers asked if they might search her flat, according to PC Greystow, she became agitated. "I suppose you have to come in," she said in the end. She had been about to go to bed. When asked why she was reluctant to let police officers enter her apartment, she said it was because she was in her dressing gown. The apartment was tidy, with no signs of disturbance, let alone the murder weapon. 2 porcelain teacups, according to Daphne Evans, they were the same teacups she and Helen had been drinking tea from earlier that evening, stood drying in the drainer beside the sink. It was only after 30 minutes searching that officers discovered the small valise on top of the wardrobe in Evans's bedroom. The valise contained clothes that were later positively identified as belonging to Helen Bostel, together with a forward-dated ticket for the boat train from Victoria, and a number of notebooks and letters, either addressed to Helen Bostel or filled with her handwriting. It was clear that Helen Bostel had been planning her getaway, that she had been keeping her plans hidden from Dylan, that she had not intended for him to accompany her on her journey. When asked why this was, she stated that she had decided to break with Dylan permanently and was determined not to get into an argument with him. Edwin's temper had become unreliable. I didn't want there to be a scene. When the prosecuting counsel pressed her on whether she was, in fact, afraid of Dylan, she hesitated and then said no. Edwin was domineering, but I was used to that, she said. He would never have done me physical harm. When questioned about the row she'd had with Dylan on the evening of his death, Helen Bostel seemed completely bemused. I barely saw Edwin all day, she said. I was working in the library for most of the morning. Then in the afternoon I saw three of my private pupils at Milliver Road. I have no idea where Edwin was at that time. He came back to the flat at around 6 o'clock. He seemed tired and irritable, but no more so than usual. I told him I was going to Daphne's, that I would be back around 11. Those were the last words I spoke to him. I left the flat soon afterwards. She hesitated. We really didn't have much to say to each other any more. The police seemed determined right from the start that Helen was the killer. She had a motive, Dylan's coercive behaviour, and she had her escape already planned. A further breakthrough came the following day when the murder weapon, a serrated steel kitchen knife with a scratched wooden handle, was discovered jammed into a crack in the wall separating the back garden of 112 Milliver Road from the garden of 114. The blade was caked in dried blood, later proved to be one of the same blood type as Edwin Dillon's. Three clear fingerprints were found on the handle, all Helen's. Helen freely admitted that the knife was hers, that it had come from her kitchen. She strongly denied that she had used it to murder Dylan. When asked who she thought had killed her lover, she said she didn't know. Edwin was always falling in and out of love with people. He thrived on dissent. He didn't have friends, so much as sparring partners, political cronies, most of them. People he knew from before we met. I gave up having anything to do with them a long time ago. When asked why that was, Helen Bostel stated that she no longer cared for their company. They were all men, obsessed with themselves and their own self-importance. They barely knew I existed. I'm sure some of them hated Edwin. He could be obnoxious. Whether any of them hated him enough to want to kill him, I have no idea. For 2 or 3 days, attention veered away from Helen as the police went in search of Dylan's political associates, many of whom, as Helen had suggested, turned out to have grievances against him. Then on February the 5th, just as things were starting to get interesting, officers received an anonymous tip-off concerning a Louise Titchener of Highgate Village. This person, or persons, insisted that Miss Titchener had been conducting an affair with Edwin Dylan, and that Helen Bostel had known about it. When found and questioned, Titchener, who belonged to one of the suffragist groups also attended by Bostel, readily confessed to the affair, with the additional information that Dylan had been planning to leave Bostel and marry her. We were going to leave London, Titchener said. We were happy. Helen confirmed that she knew Titchener by sight from the women's group, but denied she knew anything about an affair between her and Dylan. She reaffirmed that her own relationship with Dylan was as good as over, and the idea that she might have murdered him out of jealousy was ridiculous. What Edwin did with his time or his affections was none of my business, she said. If it is true that this young woman put her trust in Edwin, I would have been afraid for her. but the tide had turned. Louise Titchener's evidence, together with Irene Wilbur's statement, the clothes and travel tickets hidden at Daphne Evans' flat, the evidence seemed damning. Paradoxically, Helen's fortitude under questioning, her refusal to break down on the witness stand, may actually have helped in securing a conviction. Helen Bostel was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death. She was hanged at Holloway Prison on the morning of August 14, 1928. 3 weeks after her execution, the hangman, Arthur Rawlin, resigned from the prison service and took up a position as a warehouseman for a minor shipping company part-owned by friends of his brother, a decision that meant a considerable drop in his standard of living. More than one enterprising journalist clamoured for Rawlin's story, but he refused to comment, saying merely that he was done with the hanging game and that was that. I found that interesting. Rawlin wasn't the first hangman to lose his stomach for the profession either. John Ellis, who executed Edith Thompson in 1923, ended up committing suicide. Although some said it was his alcoholism that did for him, most people agreed that Ellis never got over the appalling brutality of Edith's execution. There have been others, too. Look them up if you don't believe me. It was thinking about Arthur Rawlin that prompted me to call on Lewis Usher. Lewis was an old client of mine. I'd helped him fight off the property acquisitions company that wanted to tear down the historic Methodist chapel that backed onto his home in Greenwich and turn it into a Tesco Metro. And it was during our war with Sequest Holdings that I happened to find out he was an expert on British murder trials, as well as an enthusiastic collector of murder memorabilia. I always enjoyed going to see Lewis. He tells the most amusing anecdotes, and his house on Croom's Hill contains more weird and wonderful collectibles than you'd hope to see in most provincial museums. When I visited him on that particular afternoon in late November, I was hoping he might have something enlightening to tell me about the Bostel execution, and I was not disappointed. Do you think Arthur Rawlin gave up his job because he came to believe that Helen Bostel was innocent? I asked him. It's a strong possibility, Lewis said. There was more to it than that, though. People gossiped that Arthur Rawlin was in love with Bostel, that he believed he was, anyway. The prison governor reported that he used to visit Helen Bostel in her cell during the run-up to her execution. There was a strange little article about it in the Evening Standard afterwards. You'd probably put his behaviour down to Stockholm syndrome now, but it really was quite odd. He spooned more sugar into his tea. You do know I have his watch. I felt my heartbeat quicken. Arthur Rawlin's watch? The one he used to time his executions? I think you'll find it was Albert Pierpoint who used to do that. Rawlin might have copied him, I suppose. There was certainly a cult of personality around Pierpoint at the time. It's Rawlin's watch, though, definitely, whatever he used it for. I have the full provenance. Could I see it? I found myself becoming excited in a way that seemed completely out of proportion with what Lewis had told me. It was just a watch, after all. But it was as if I knew even then that I was about to make a significant discovery, not just about Arthur Rawlin, but about Helen Bostel. Of course, won't be a tick. He eased himself out of his chair and shuffled off towards the side room where he kept most of his collection. I couldn't help noticing he relied on his cane more than he had on my last visit. Still, he seemed in good spirits. I gazed around the living room, the ancient red plush sofas, the fake stuffed dodo in its glass case, the walls and mantel shelf crowded with photographs of his wife, The stage actress, Zoe Clifford, dead from a freak bout of pneumonia some 10 years before. The place had become something of a haven for me during the Sequest case, which had happened to coincide with the first stage of my breakup with Ray. How glad I had been to come here, to escape from my own thoughts and misgivings into this cosy little corner of theatre land, where the fire was always lit and the stories were always larger and more preposterous than my own. A place suspended in time, a lacuna in the fraying fabric of the everyday world. "Here it is," Lewis said. I jumped, startled. I'd been so absorbed in my thoughts, I hadn't noticed him come back into the room. He was carrying a small bag made from yellow silk with a drawstring opening. "I can show you the papers, too, if you'd like to see them. But this is the watch." He passed me the bag. I reached cautiously inside. Things inside bags make me nervous. You don't know what you're getting into until it's too late. In this case, Rawlins' watch, which was a full-case silver pocket watch about 2 inches in diameter. The front of the case was engraved with a lighted candle. On the back was a skull, the eye sockets and nasal cavities etched out in darker relief. The classic vanitas, life and death, light and darkness. The universal allegory for time's passing. Perfect for a hangman, I thought. "He may have commissioned the engraving personally," Lewis said, as if reading my thoughts. "Although the design isn't unusual for the time. The Victorians were heavily into mourning jewellery, as you probably know." "Yes, though it's more my brother's area, to be honest." I flipped open the front of the case. The watch's white enamelled face was simple and plain, as if in deliberate contrast to the Gothic extravagance of the case. There was a date stamped on the dial, 1879, and a name, I supposed, of the maker, Owen Andrews. The name meant nothing to me, but I made a mental note to ask Martin about it later. "It's a tourbillon watch," Lewis added. "Very expensive, even at the time. An ordinary working man like Rawlin would have had to save several months' salary to purchase it." "What's a tourbillon?" "A means for stabilizing the watch's mechanism so that it doesn't lose time. Here." He opened the back of the watch, revealing its workings, which resembled a complicated mechanical diagram, all gears and levers. "Have a look at this." He angled his hand, showing me the inside back of the watch's case and the photograph that had been secreted there. The image showed a young woman with short dark hair and light eyes, a narrow straight nose and a high lace collar. Helen Bostel. "There is a possibility that the photograph was placed inside the watch later, after Rawlins' death, I mean," said Lewis. "It's unlikely, though. You won't read much about this in the newspapers, but if you delve a little deeper, you'll find there are several contemporary accounts from colleagues and family and so on. All of them agree that Rawlin was living in a fantasy world." "About him and Helen being in love, you mean?" "Yes, that. But it went even further," he chuckled. "I read one letter from Rawlin to his younger brother, where he was going on about travelling back in time to prevent the execution he himself had carried out." "That's ridiculous. Poor man. Plenty would say he got what he deserved. Not everyone would feel sorry for a hangman." "I did, though. We can't all choose our jobs. And was Rawlin so different from the soldiers sent out to kill other soldiers on the battlefields of World War I? I tried to imagine how he must have felt, becoming properly aware for the first time of what his job meant, what it was he did. The imagining was not pleasant. Too bad we can't bring him back to talk to the Americans, I said. I smiled to myself, thinking how Martin would disapprove of my poor taste in jokes. He would love to see this watch, though, I thought, which gave me an idea. Please say no if you want to, I said to Lewis, but could I possibly borrow this, just for a day or two? I'd like to show it to my brother. The watch? He fell silent, and I was fully expecting him to demur, to begin explaining how he didn't like to let items from his collection leave the house, especially not an item such as this, which was valuable even aside from who had once owned it. I'd like you to have it, was what he actually said. I felt so surprised and so shocked that for a moment I couldn't answer him. Lewis, don't be silly, I couldn't possibly. I'm sorry I asked, I said when I could. I mean it, he insisted. I've been wanting to leave you something, in my will, I mean, to say thank you for being such a good friend to me. But it's difficult to know what someone might like. If I know you like this, then you've made my task easier. You'll be doing me a favour. You're not ill. Dying, you mean? No. No more so than usual, but I am 86. Lewis, I said, thank you. It's my great pleasure, so long as you don't use it to go running off after repentant hangmen. We both laughed at that, both of us at the same time. But I've sometimes had the feeling, call it hindsight if you want, that neither of us actually thought it was funny. Helen's defence rested on the fact that the evidence against her was circumstantial. No one, not even Irene Wilbur, claimed to have seen her in the vicinity of Milliver Road at the time of Dylan's death. And no matter how many times the prosecution cross-examined Daphne Evans over Helen's alibi, she never deviated from her original statement. Helen had arrived at her apartment just before seven. They ate some sandwiches Daphne had prepared and talked about Edwin. Helen still felt guilty for what she was planning, to walk out on him without a word of warning. But Daphne remained adamant she was doing the right thing. I never liked Edwin, she said. He wasn't trustworthy. I was glad when Helen decided she was leaving him. I knew she wasn't happy. When asked whether she considered Dylan to be a violent man, Daphne hesitated before replying and then said yes, adding, I would have said he could be capable of violence. I was afraid for Helen, just sometimes, but she always told me I was being foolish, so I had to believe her. The prosecution's most important witness was Irene Wilbur. Her insistence that there had been a furious altercation at 112 Milliver Road just before 8 o'clock was more instrumental in securing a guilty verdict than Helen Bostel's fingerprints on the murder weapon. You didn't have to be a lawyer to understand that anyone could have used that knife, that the killer would have been likely to grab the first weapon to come to hand, especially if the murder had been opportunistic rather than planned. That Helen Bostel kept a carving knife in her kitchen drawer was hardly damning evidence. On the other hand, Irene Wilbur was adamant that she had heard two people yelling at each other, that one of them had been a woman. And she had Gerald Honeyshot of the Red Lion to back her up regarding the time. Why would Irene Wilbur lie? When asked by the prosecution if she had any reason to dislike or resent Helen Bostel, if there was any previous bad feeling between them, Wilbur was equally adamant that there hadn't been. I barely knew her, she stated. I'd not been living at Milliver Road for more than a fortnight. I'd seen her a few times to say hello to, but that was all. She seemed friendly enough, A bit aloof, perhaps, but not what you call unpleasant. In fact, Irene Wilbur had been resident at 112 Milliver Road for just 10 days. The defence did not appear to find anything suspicious in that, and why would they? People move house all the time. Wilbur's assertion that she had moved to Camden from Putney in order to be closer to grandchildren and because she had numerous friends in the area seemed entirely reasonable. I don't know what kept me picking away at Irene Wilbur, but I did. I didn't like the way she had been so relentless in the way she'd given her evidence, so determined almost, that Helen was guilty. Wilbur had persisted even while knowing that Helen might face a death sentence if convicted. Why such animosity towards a woman she claimed not to have known? I didn't get it. Those who thought to criticise Wilbur at the time did so on the grounds that she was a natural attention seeker, altogether too enamoured of seeing herself in the newspapers. An interesting hypothesis, but I wasn't so certain. Was it possible, I wondered, that Irene Wilbur had been a stooge? Most newspaper accounts of the trial made mention of Wilbur's smart attire, and several made particular mention of a jade and diamond brooch she wore. Everyone seemed to agree she was a handsome woman. After pursuing the matter a little further, I discovered that Irene Wilbur had moved away from Milliver Road less than a week after Helen's execution, that she had returned to her old stamping ground of Putney and to considerably smarter lodgings than she had occupied previously. If Irene Wilbur had been paid to provide false evidence, it suggested not only that Dylan's murder had been carefully planned, but that Helen had been intended to take the blame all along. If this was so, and once I stumbled upon the idea, I found it difficult to give up the conviction that it was, then Irene Wilbur would have to be connected with Edwin Dylan in some way, or rather with his enemies, who would scarcely have risked employing a stranger to do their dirty work. On top of my research into the lives of Helen Bostall and Edwin Dylan, I now found myself grubbing around for any information I could find about Irene Wilbur. I soon discovered she had been married at the age of 21 to a Major Douglas Wilbur, who had been killed at the Battle of Amiens in World War I. They had one child, a daughter named Laura, born in the February of 1919, a full 6 months after her father's death. Those dates seemed odd to me. Of course, it was entirely possible that Major Wilbur had been afforded leave prior to the Amiens campaign, that Laura could have been conceived then. But it didn't fit somehow, not to my mind anyway. Douglas Wilbur had been an experienced, valuable, and loyal officer. It was inconceivable that he would have left his post immediately before such a crucial offensive. There was also the fact that Irene Wilbur was 38 years old at the time of Laura's birth, that during the whole of her 20-year marriage there had been no other children. What had changed? If Douglas Wilbur was not in fact Laura's father, who was? I looked back once again over the trial records, focusing on any mention of Irene Wilbur's home life, no matter how minor. Which is how I came to notice something that had not registered before, namely that Laura Wilbur had not been resident at Milliver Road, that at the time of the murder she was staying instead with a person Irene Wilbur described as a near relative, a Mrs. Jocelyn Bell, close to the Wilburs' old address in Putney. When questioned about why her daughter was not in fact living with her, Irene Wilbur said it was a matter of Laura's schooling. Once again, it was possible. But by now I was coming to believe it was more likely a matter of Irene not wanting her daughter anywhere near a house where she knew there was going to be a murder. Wilbur would not be staying long at Milliver Road in any case. Far better to keep Laura at a distance. I was filled with a sense of knowing, the feeling that always comes over me when I understand I have discovered an insight into a case that has hitherto kept itself obstinately hidden. I knew that I was close to something, that the pieces of the truth were more than likely already assembled, that it was simply a matter of arranging them in the correct order. The first step, I decided, was to try and find out a little more about Jocelyn Bell. And in the meantime, I still had to talk to Martin about the hangman's watch.